This is The Good Die Young, the podcast where we deep dive into the greatest television you barely saw. I'm your host, Les Weiler. Join me as I take you through what made these shows too pretty to live. This is The Good Die Young. Season 1, The Middleman. Hey, it's Les from The Good Die Young. Well, we've reached the end of season one, and to cap it off, I've got a wrap-up interview with Middleman creator Javier Grillo Marxwatch. We talked about how many Philip K. Dick references you can actually put in one project, how Noser got his name, and a lot of other obscure stuff about a show that, if you're listening to this, you clearly love. I hope you enjoy. Hello, this is Les.
Hey, Les, it's Javi. How are you?
Doing great. How are you?
So far, so good. I have a lot of great work and great material that's going to be coming out in the next year and a half that I'm very excited about sort of putting out into the world. And, you know, it's all going really well. So
yeah, watching you on social media, you look like you've had a busy past few months. Were you in England with the filming for Dark Crystal prequel?
No. I am supposed to at some point visit England to watch the filming and do a little bit of work on the show. But it is a difficult, large, and involved production over there. And I also have gone to work on a show called Blood and Treasure, which is going to be a summer series for CBS in 2019. So I'm doing a consultancy on that show and then hopefully returning to The Dark Crystal. We'll see. So, you know, lots very busy. Lots going on.
I think I'd seen you mention Blood and Treasure. Was that a show, created by friends of yours?
Well, there's these two very nice men named Steven Skaya and Matthew Fetterman who created the show. And I had worked with them on Charlie's Angels, which I'm sure you remember as one of the high points of American network television. they have now gotten to the point where they have gotten their own show on the air, and they were gracious enough to invite me to see if I could add something to it, and I'm hoping I can. So, you know, it's really fun. It's also nice. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, I'm saying it's also really okay, you go. You.
All right, fine. I just seen your name pop up on Shannara Chronicles as well, and was like, well, of course Javi's involved with this. Yes.
Well, Shannara, it's interesting. Shannara, you know, the second season was actually, I think we wrote it in 2016, and then the show came out in 2017, the second season of it. And I fear that the show sort of got lost in the shuffle from when Spike became the Paramount Network. But weirdly, that show was actually created by Miller and Goff, who created Charlie's Angels. And I guess I did well at Charlie's Angels because it's the fact they've hired me once more, and then Sky and Fetterman have hired me. So I guess I made a good impression on that show.
It's an important lesson that even jobs you don't think are huge are huge.
Well, you know, I think with Charlie's Angels, it's funny. Yeah. I mean, it's exactly that. And I don't think Charlie's Angels wasn't huge. In fact, it was when we did the show, it was a very important show for the network and for its creators. And sadly, it did not go as everybody would have expected. Although I'm proud to say that I put the nail on that coffin, since the show was canceled the day after my first episode aired. And that was also the day that my second episode wrapped. So I feel like I was really in there with a hammer and some very long nails, just, you know. But yeah, you have to, you know, look, any job you go to, you have to do your best and make a good impression and be somebody that people want to work with. You know, it doesn't matter, you know, what you think or don't think. It matters what you put up and how you behave with other people, you know, and hopefully you keep getting hired, you know.
Can I ask, what's it been like listening to somebody slow crawl through
well, you know, through your project? I'm glad that you wanted to do a wrap up / follow up interview with me, because I really wanted to thank you. It's I hope that I haven't been your only listener, though I suspect that a little bit. But no, I mean, you know, it's been really cool. You know, I think that there's a very powerful and primal emotion that people feel when they're understood, you know, and when they feel like they're understood by other people. And it's interesting, because I was trying to think of whether there's a word to express that. But it's an extremely powerful set of emotions that you have when somebody repeats back to you what you've said and you realize that they've gotten it, you know? And, it's been enormously gratifying listening to the podcast that you made of the show. And occasionally tweeting out a correction or two, but generally feeling like you and your co-hosts, the variety of your co-hosts really have vibed with the show and understood it. And, you know, it's been a really gratifying experience for me. So I'm very grateful to you for even doing this. You know, and I think that, you know, I don't want to say failure, but I think obscurity on the magnitude that we have with the middleman is both a great thing, because people who are going to love the middleman have to find it, you know, so there's a certain self-selection to it. But there's days when, as the creator of a show, you sort of think, my God, was I just screaming into a void, you know? And it's nice to know that I wasn't.
For me, I was really, I kind of made the podcast thinking, well, Javi will listen to it maybe. And I've been really amazed that there are fans that put me to shame, and I've just done this podcast. Mm-hmm. The love of the show, I wasn't wrong. Like, it, you know, it struck me, and I knew it struck other people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, and it's funny because, you know, as you know, I crowdfunded the revival that I have not yet listened to today's podcast. So I'm very eager to hear about the Penn Universal parental reconciliation recap. But, you know, like those fans, they put a lot of money into getting that table read to happen and into making sure that we had a really nice book. And I feel like middle fans, you know, look, if all of the middle fans said, you know, okay, we're done with the middleman, we're good, I'd be like, you guys have given enough. Certainly, you're more than welcome to, you know. But it's nice that they keep showing up and that they keep sort of enjoying what this project is, you know, and kind of what it stands for. And I feel like it kind of belongs to everybody at this point, you know, because every person who likes it seems to be actually playing a key role in keeping it alive. You know, we're all in the same, circle of sorcery to try to maintain this property from slipping entirely into obscurity. And that's a very nice thing.
Having gone through this whole thing now, was there a reason that Kanem and Kang didn't make the jump from the comic?
Well, actually, you sort of got that slightly wrong in the podcast, because you mentioned that we had drawn Manservant Neville to look like Mark Shepard. But the truth is, I mean, and that's exactly what we did. So what happened with Mark Shepard was the reason. So Mark was actually a friend of mine before I did the comic book. And Mark, I had cast him in The Chronicle, which was the Sci-Fi Channel show I did. And then I put him in the show called Jake 2.0. And then I had also tried to get him on Medium. And he wound up doing an episode of Medium that Rob Doherty wrote, because he'd had this really cool character. So I really was part of the very early surge of the Mark Shepard continuous employment movement, you know,
yes,
which is a movement that postulates that Mark Shepard be in as many shows as possible. And I feel like it's a good movement, and I think people should continue to support it.
Yeah, it's a union rule that he has to be in all genre shows, I thought.
Exactly. So Mark was already a dear friend, and I was talking to him about his role in Firefly, and because I didn't really watch Firefly, I always thought he was wearing some sort of a fur suit in Firefly. And then he explained to me, no, I was wearing like a vest and a tie. I don't know why you think that I was wearing a fur suit. So I thought, well, if somebody hasn't put Mark in a fur suit, I'll do it. So the original Manservant Neville was always wearing a gorilla, the bottom half, like a gorilla suit without a gorilla head on. Obviously that didn't make it on the TV show. So the idea of Mark being in it was prior to even the drawing of it and the comic and the television show. And I think, you know, okay, so the fat boy thing, actually, I know this is a very circuitous answer, and it'll probably take the whole podcast, but you seem to enjoy the way I express things, so I'll just indulge myself. The fat boy thing is actually an inside joke that I learned of from I worked on this when I was a network executive. There was a show on NBC called The Mommies. And it was a show based on the stand-up of these two women who were moms, whose whole stand-up was sort of about being a mommy and all that, right? And in the prop people and the line producer for that show had everything be Fat Boys. So they had like Fat Boy pizza, Fat Boy donuts and things like that, right? And it was pretty suburban, so it was kind of contained. So it was just the food services because they were constantly having pizza delivered and all that, right? And in fact, it may have only been the pizza. And then I started talking to the line producer and she goes, "Hi, everything should be Fat Boy. There should be Fat Boy eggs and Fat Boy donuts and this and that." And so I kind of ran with it. And when we got to doing the television show of The Middleman, and I put it in different things and all that. And then when we got to the television show of The Middleman, it seemed like it was too early to give The Middleman a specter, you know?
Yeah.
And the original Fat Boy was very much the specter of The Middleman. But it didn't really like, I don't know. I feel like it would have spun us like The Middleman. One of the nice balancing acts that we did in The Middleman was that we always sort of kept the balance between our creature of the week, our spy theme and all that. But without the show, like the mythology got dense, but it was like, I don't know. I felt there was something that you kind of needed to see the creation of it or see it happen spontaneously in its own way. And just something that happens a lot in TV shows is, you know, you guys were always very kind about talking about how detailed the world was. And I think that that's, you know, some of it is by architecture, but some of it is just by sheer dint of curation. You know, you let the writer's room, you know, run and you let the writer's room come up with ideas and you let a bunch of things into the show. And then you slowly sort of weed out the ones that aren't going to help you in the future. You know, I mean, in that way, creating a TV show is a lot like doing an improv, you know, where you have a theme and you kind of do the improv around the theme until you kind of figure out what your scene is going to be, you know? So I think by the time we got to like, you know, past the mid season and all that, we had been doing the Fat Boy joke pretty consistently. And it just makes me laugh every time. And I know that that's, I pretty much like, look, listening to the podcast and watching the show again, and then the amount of joy I get from the show and I got from your podcast, I literally believe that I should change my name to Norma Desmond or to Nora Desmond, you know, because I generally feel like Gloria Swanson in Sunset Boulevard, you know? but anyway, so the Fat Boy joke, though, it was just something I really loved. And we sort of got to the middle of the season and we were really thinking about kind of how to create a big bad for the season. And it just, you know what? It just didn't feel right to have Fat Boy be this nemesis organization. It felt like it needed to be something that came out organically. But, you know, I mean, Mark Shepard is around. You can't have a genre show without Mark Shepard. So Manservant Neville had to come in the show. And I think it also gave a nice differentiation between the TV and the series universe. You know, it sort of made them different animals, you know, the TV universe and the comic book universe, you know?
Yeah.
So that was a very long answer.
One of the things that struck me strikingly different between the comic book universe and the TV universe, right at the end of the original run of the comics, right before Kahneman Kang darts him in the neck and
right.
All of that, Wendy is standing there facing a choice between being a middleman or following her art dream,
right.
Which is something that TV Wendy almost pointedly never has to face.
Yeah.
And it kind of struck me that like, oh, that's something I really took away from the show was that you don't have to give up your personal, you know, relationships to have a job.
Right.
But then the comic was just almost facing her with it. So that the Wendy we meet in the Pan Universal, is a Wendy who's kind of just faced that choice.
Well, you know what? You have to realize that the comic book, even though they're very similar and the basic attitude of the comic book is very much that of the TV show, they are different animals. And I was a very different person when I wrote the comic books than I was when we did the TV show. I feel like you can't underestimate the influence of the writing staff in terms of continuing to push the agenda of positivity that I set out. In my own, you know, sort of when left to my own devices, even though, like I said, I set that agenda of positivity, you know, look, your life goes up and down. And there were many years between the writing of the original pilot and the writing of the last comic. And I'd been, you know, I'm pretty certain that when the third comic was being drawn and all of that, that I was going through something very, very different than I was when I first wrote it. And I don't think that the sort of positivity of what the middleman needed to be had really calcified in my mind yet, you know? Like, I knew I wanted to make an optimistic show, and I knew that I wanted the theme to be that superheroism doesn't have to ruin your life. But, you know, I think I was a little more susceptible to the currents of my own life and my own mood. And I did not have as strong a true north as I did when I had the show and the writers. So that ending is a lot darker. And look, I mean, the original ending for that comic book was really kind of pitch black, because Wendy was not going to take a new apprentice, and Wendy just works alone, and Wendy looked pretty worse for the wear, having been a middleman, you know?
Yeah, she really looks like the Pliskin Mirror Universe middleman.
Yeah. Yeah, and look, I think that that's a lot of, you know, look, not everybody, no single person is indomitable in their attitude toward the world. The world tests you different ways, and sometimes you have, you're just sadder, you know? And I think I was going through a period in my life when, life had piled a couple of things on me that really, put me in the mood to write that ending. And honestly, I don't know that if the comic book universe had continued, that I would have, written that ending, you know? And frankly, there was an ending, I don't remember what exactly it was, but there was an original ending for the television show, for the Doomsday Armageddon Apocalypse. It was a little bit sadder than the one we did, you know? I honestly can't remember what it was, but I remember the cast. I think that around the time the series show wrapped, there were some very serious signs of strain in my first marriage that were happening, and there were a couple of really difficult existential sort of crises that I was facing on a personal level. And look, also on the TV show, was not, you know, for as happy and positive a show as it was, it wasn't without its own drama, you know, and by the time that we were writing the finale, you'll notice that the finale has a card that says in memory of Neil Levin. And Neil was a lovely guy that I had known for a very long time, who was our script coordinator. And Neil died during the middle of production of The Middleman, you know. And it was a very sudden and accidental death, and it put us all in a kind of very different headspace.
Yeah.
Than we might have been had the show ended a different way. So I remember very vividly that when the writers read the first version of Doomsday Armageddon Apocalypse, they were like, dude, this is a bit dark, you know? And they sort of gently nudged me back toward the light in a couple of ways, you know? And frankly, I'm happy that I had some time to reconsider Doomsday Armageddon Apocalypse and make the ending a little more optimistic than it wound up being, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, look, I think that I'm somebody who, for me, the fight for the light is a physical and ongoing one. And sometimes it's easy for me to kind of slide in the wrong direction of it. So you're probably seeing a little bit of that in the ending for the third version of the original content, the third book in the original continuity, you know?
One of the things that I've gotten from interviewing about half of the writer's staff.
Yeah, you got everybody, man. Congratulations.
Thanks. You definitely helped with that access. Everybody speaks glowingly of their time in that room. And I mean, and that's not mm-hmm. how everybody speaks of past jobs, you know, in most of it.
No, I know. I have worked in television long enough to know that.
Well, and very publicly right now in television, mm-hmm. there's been shakeups and changes. And
yeah.
Do you feel that culture's changing? And how do you personally go about trying to make sure your writer's room amplifies the better aspects of what you want to get across?
Well, look, I think the first step of it is casting, you know. I think people think they're hiring writers and they just hire as many great writers with great credits as they can, and boom, they have a great room. I think that with a writer's room, you have to cast people. You know, you have to wonder, not just are these people great writers, but can they play well together? You know, will they be able to collude, and in colluding sort of make great art, you know, or serviceable art or passable art, or not kill one another, you know? And I think in the case of The Middleman, I had known Margaret Dunlap for a long time. I had, been friends and read Sarah Watson's material for quite a while beforehand. I know she told you her sort of origin story with me. Andy Reeser was somebody that, you know, multiple people who worked on Charmed after I'd been there wrote to me to tell me, you have to hire this guy, you know? So, and they were people that I had gotten along well with and who spoke well, not just of his writing ability, but also of how he worked in the room. You know, Hans Beimler I'd worked with on The Chronicle. So, you know, it was just I kind of knew enough of the people personally and knew a lot of the people who recommended the people personally that I had a pretty good idea that this was a room that was going to gel, you know? I had worked for a whole year with Jordan on this Lost experience thing. So you start seeing, you know, you start going, I think these two will get along. I think these people will be just fine together. You know, these two might have some friction, but I can put them on opposite sides of the table until they figure it out, you know? And I think just when you put your casting hat instead of your shopping hat is when you create a great staff, you know? And hopefully I was able to do that. And look, I've seen a lot of first time showrunners. I would not have been thinking about that if I hadn't also, you know, for example, I wrote on the first season of Lost, and that's a staff that had an enormous number of real superstars in it. You know, people who've gone on to do incredible things, and people who had done incredible things even before they got on that staff. But one of the things I also noticed about that staff was that, you know, the first season staff on that show, great as they were and great as a lot of the episodes were, was not the most cohesive group in terms of their interpersonal dynamics. And I think a big part of that was that there wasn't enough consideration given to what those dynamics would be in the room, you know?
Yeah.
So I felt that coming out of that experience, and if you look at Lost, like nobody, other than me, nobody who started the first season actually survived to the second season, you know? And I think some of that had to do with the dynamics between the writer's room being a little bit difficult by just interpersonal conflicts that might have been avoided if the show had been staffed a little differently, you know?
Yeah.
And look, by the way, also, and by the way, just FYI, this also, Middleman was a fun show. I mean, like, look, we're doing episodes about zombie fish and crap like that. So, like, you know, you can't write that show in misery. You know, you need happy people who are thinking about wacky, daffy things and enjoying it. And, you know, look, I remember there was a time when I was working on the Chronicle. You know, this was one of the formative experiences that I had as a writer. I was sitting there in the editor room with Silvio Orta, who was the creator of that show and Ugly Betty and Jake 2.0. And we were editing an episode where there was this tentacle monster that ate cell phones, you know, and we were looking at a scene where the monster comes out of the ground and eats a guy for using the wrong type of cell phone. Right. And we were watching it, and the CGI comes in and the tentacles come out and they swallow the guy. And we were also happy to see that special effect that we burst out into applause in the editor's room. Right.
Yeah.
And Sylvia turns to me, and there was a show on at the time that starred Richard Dreyfuss and actually Katie Sackhoff. And Jordan turns to me and says, "Do you think the people who make The Education of Max Bickford are having this much fun?" And I said, "Nope." You know, and honestly, like, if you didn't have fun writing the middleman would have sucked. You know, like that couldn't have been, that there was a pathological aesthetic and like literally cellular level need for that show to be a happy place, you know?
Yeah. One of the odd things that I had noticed, there's a couple of scenes where Wendy on the show is wearing a Jolly Fats t-shirt.
Yeah.
Was that just something that the crew put together, or?
Yeah. I mean, honestly, I don't think I asked for it. I mean, one of the nice things about working in a show, and look, I mean, it's easy in hindsight to look at it as some sort of workers' paradise, but by and large, The Middleman was a pretty happy show and a good place to work at, even though everybody was, you know, working under an ABC Family budget and couldn't get all the things they wanted for the set and couldn't get all the things all the money they wanted for themselves. But people were by and large very happy because the show was a very open place where there was a lot of room for everybody to express their creativity. And after a while, after a couple episodes, one of the things that I'm happiest about that experience is that people got into it and they would make things and show them to me and say, "Can we put this in the show?" You know, I mean, there'd be like a prop or something, you know, and I'm pretty certain that the Jolly Fats Weehawken shirt was something like that, that someone in the art department put the logo on a shirt and I went, Wendy has to wear that, you know? And it's just, you know, and it's just one of those happy things where somebody gets into it, you see it and you go, "Wow, I'm really happy with this thing you did on your free time. Go ahead and put it in," you know?
Yeah.
And I also just like the idea that Jolly Fats, you know, like I know you guys talked about it at a fair length in the podcast, that it's weird that the fake temp agency has its own t-shirt. But then again, they have a lot of other things.
Yeah, it's true. This is not the weirdest swag.
I mean, like, you know, and by the way, the reason Ida makes coffee in a Fat Boy cup is because Ida is generating all of that stuff internally. So she's trying to replicate what Wendy drinks all the time. You know, it's not that Ida was made by Fat Boy or that Ida has Fat Boy cups. I mean, everything's just being, Ida basically has a replicator in her body.
So she's making the cup and the coffee.
So she was actually making the cup and the coffee in order to make Wendy feel comfortable that she is having a, you know, something that is reflective of her everyday life. I was very concerned about answering that question when I heard that second episode of the
podcast. That weirdly puts my mind at ease that there's not a nefarious Spectre level.
No, Ida
scheme.
Was not built. No. It, yeah, and it was strictly to, you know, look, Ida's entire purpose is to keep everybody stocked and to keep the organization running. So if coffee is what was needed to keep the organization running, and she made some generic, you know, double red eye for Wendy, Wendy would probably not be a very happy camper, you know.
I assume she made the commander's Fleming Jamaican. Probably just made the rum as well.
I don't know. I think she actually. I think for that she actually probably went out and got it, you know, because you know I 69 probably had a liquor store that he liked or something like that, you know. And also I don't think no matter how much you've mastered the creation of objects on the molecular level, I don't think anybody could make high karate. You know, it's a very specific smell. Ida can make everything except for high karate. That's her kryptonite. And it was sad because we couldn't actually use a real, because, you know, high karate, they stopped making it, I think, in the late 70s. It was like a, it was very much like a 70s thing. You know, it was part of that, you know, swinging 70s, you know, sexual revolution kind of culture thing, you know. So it was, and I think, I don't think it even, I can't imagine it exists anymore. You know, it's an artifact of my childhood that I remember the commercials, you know.
Can I ask how Noser got named?
Yes. So Noser, there is a book written by Philip K. Dick, who is probably my favorite author, and I have read at least 80% of his novels, of all 36 of his novels. And one of the books that he wrote is called A Maze of Death, which is a show about, which is a novel in which characters are stuck in a... In an increasingly hostile planet that seems more and more arbitrary in its rules, and the ships that they fly in were these little ships called Nosers, and I just love the name, and I thought if I ever had a ship, it would have to be a Noser, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I just, you know, when I was writing the book, I was well in the thick of my Philip K. Dick phase, and would always name a character or something after something from Philip K. Dick, just to kind of pay homage to Philip K. Dick, because his work was so important to me. And I just thought that this was perfect, you know. And I don't know, like it's not something that would have probably that had any kind of antecedent in the life of the character. I just sort of thought that's a cool name, and since this guy's going to be sort of weird and mysterious, and I mean, as you know, I think you mistakenly said he was a botanist, but he's in fact an entomologist.
Yes, entomologist.
Yeah, you're probably now starting to realize just how creepily much I have retained from listening to your podcast.
Yeah, that was one during the editing where I stopped and went, "Ah, crap, I can't fix that."
But anyway, you know, I think that it was just a funny name that I thought, like, you know, when he was just a sort of white hippie guy sitting there, and then, you know, we cast. You know, we cast Jake and I don't know, the name just stuck with me.
That's great.
You know? And he really didn't have a name for a while. We were going to like, oh my God, Jordan had this amazing pitch where there was like a replacement Noser at one point, and it was just, if there could be such a thing, it was just too weird for the show, but we wanted to do one. There were two things that we didn't get to do in the show that I wish we had at some point, that the show had lasted longer so we could get to that. One of them was, for one episode, Noser was going to be replaced by a sort of heavily accented, somewhat obese, middle-aged Armenian man called Noserian. And he was just going to be there, and like people were going to ask him why he was there. And he's like, "I am Noserian. I replaced Noser today." You know? Never got to do that. Probably for the better. We would have probably had the Armenian community be upset with us. And the other one was, do you remember Noser's roommate, Anvil?
Yes.
So there was a whole thing we were going to do where Anvil only spoke in gibberish, but everybody understood him. And we were never going to explain it. We were literally just going to have him speak in gibberish, and everybody would just talk to him like he was speaking in plain English.
Like the way Han understands Chewie, and yeah.
Exactly, exactly. Or the way that everybody understands the Amazing Yen in the Ocean's 11 movies, you know?
Yeah.
Even though he only speaks Chinese. And yeah, the network would not let us do that. Actually, did Jordan tell you about the milkshake thing that we couldn't do either?
No.
Okay, so in Jordan, so as you know, in Jordan's episode, Interadroid is the one who brings us the message from High Alduin, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the original way that the message from High Alduin was going to arrive was that there was going to be a knock at the door of Jolly Fat's Weehawken, and there was going to be a little, like a 12, 13-year-old boy in, like, a soda jerk costume, right? And he was going to be like, milkshake delivery. And middleman was like, and Wendy would be like, but we didn't order milkshakes. And then when middleman sees him, he realizes what's happening. And he takes the milkshakes, and him and Wendy drink the milkshake. And then they were going to have, like, this sort of psychedelic 2001 Stargate experience, right? And then they were going to land in this completely black space, and High Alduin was going to appear there, right? And the idea, and so the idea was that in order to communicate at such vast interstellar distances, they basically needed to take LSD, okay?
Yeah.
And speak to High Alduin through a kind of psychic ansible, because otherwise, okay.
You'd meet him in the Bardo, and yeah.
Exactly. So Jordan wrote the sequence. And one of the best things about it was that at some points during the whole wavy, gravy, hippy-dippy Stargate sequence, there was going to be like a disembodied head of Ida that was going to be orbiting the Earth and just going, hey, 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 like Sputnik. You know how Sputnik uh-huh. beeped every 20 seconds? Except it was going to be her going, hey. So anyway, so we showed that to ABC Family, and they called us, and they were like, we can't do this. And I'm like, why not? We don't have the money. And they're like, no, it's just too weird. And I'm like, why is it too weird? That's how we communicate. And they're like, oh yeah, where did the soda jerk boy come from? And I'm like, and it was the only time where I had a hesitation. And when I hesitated for half a second, they went, aha, you don't know what it is. It's too weird. You can't do it. Right. So I hung up the phone with a network president, and then VP. And then as I stood up, I said, there is a guild of intergalactic messengers. Whose costume looks exactly like a 13-year-old soda jerk. Who basically their job is to go around the galaxy, making it possible for people to communicate by giving people these milkshakes, right? So I called the network back, like 2 minutes later, I get the executive on the phone, and I'm like, there's an intergalactic guild of messengers who make sure that people at vast distances can communicate by giving them hallucinogenic milkshakes. And she takes this in for a minute and then goes, nah, you just made that up. You can't do it. So then we have to figure out the other way to do it.
Oh, that's great.
It could have been a weirder show. I mean, not for a lack of trying, you know?
Oh, that's great. I wanted to ask, did the Ann Arbor Fred Butler story have any root in anything?
The middleman's?
Yeah.
Well, you know what? I honestly, not really. I went to Huron High School in Ann Arbor, and I try to put Ann Arbor in everything I do. We actually, if you watch Lost, Ann Arbor is the home of the Dharma Initiative. And I just occasionally like to put in Ann Arbor because it's like my favorite city in the world, and I just love it there. And I have so many great friends there. So that part was it. And also Matt Kiesler's from Michigan. So I thought probably evoking his home state might not be the worst thing. And but honestly, the story was made up out of whole cloth, probably by Sarah Watson. This is the kid who breaks his leg because middleman wasn't paying attention, right?
Yes, correct.
Yeah. So, and I think, look, the truth of the matter is that if middleman and I had been in high school together, we probably would not have been in the same social circles or had a lot of experience in common. No, we were trying to make it was made up by Sarah to sort of reflect the kind of experience a guy like the middleman might have had at that point in his life, you know?
Scrolls of Xanthor, speaking of Clotharians earlier.
Uh-huh.
I mean, other than, I think there's a Futurama character, but where did Xanthor spring from?
I think Jordan Rosenberg made that up, because that was in, Scrolls of Xanthor was in the first episode with High Alduin, right?
Yes. Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah. So I think that was a Jordan Rosenberg invention, and I think it had to do with sort of, he finds great glee in made up sci-fi names for things, you know? But then in the second one, the Treaty of Peri-Perpigilium was part of the Doctor Who. And by the way, you missed one huge Doctor Who reference in that episode, not in Jordan's, in
Margaret's.
Yes. Because, what's his name? Tyler Ford went to McCrimmon College, and one of the Doctor's first two companions when it was William Hartnell was Jamie McCrimmon.
Ah.
So, yes. Yep. Yes.
Yeah, we missed that one. That's it. I don't take home the prize money now.
No, I think does it suck that you're like doing a wrap up interview with the person who created the show? You've done a podcast for the last 6 months on, and I'm like schooling you.
No, I keep trying to tell friends that like I feel like I've still missed an entire layer of freaking references of this show. It feels bottomless.
So did I, most likely. So it's okay.
There are aliens in the comics that don't make it in the show. Right. The aliens from Frodis 9.
Yes. Now, that's also that's also a Philip K. Dick reference. Philip K. Dick wrote a book called Our Friends from Frolix 8.
Okay.
But it's actually a combination. I don't know. Did I say Frodis or Prolix? I have a copy of the comic book right here. Let me find out. if it's Frodis, I use Frodis a lot. Frodis is actually an homage to the monkeys.
I was about to say, I thought that was the last episode of the monkeys. Yeah, F-O-R-D-I-S, yes. Frodis, yeah.
Yes, that's the Frodis, because there was a plant, a hallucinogenic plant from outer space called the Frodis, that features into one episode of the monkeys, that's what that was.
Yeah. So it's
like a combination Philip K. Dick monkeys reference.
So it's like Frop from the Subgenius, I think is what
probably yes.
I think Frop is what Bob Dobbs always smoked.
Yeah. I was delighted that you that you dug all of the Subgenius references. I had forgotten you're from close to where the Church of the Subgenius has its holy see, as it were.
Yeah, I grew up about an hour away from Dallas, and finding out that there was that much weird that close was just great.
Dude, you know what? Here's the thing. Like the great thing about the Church of the Subgenius and everything they represent, but it's interesting because I feel like Church of the Subgenius is in its own way like a little bit of a relic, you know. They used to have the Subgenius Church put out a book called High Weirdness by Mail, you know, and there's a whole world that's been lost. That was a world of, you know, before the internet. And I feel like the internet has sort of made weird into like just a little bit too easily accessible, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't say that with any nostalgia for the good old days. It sucked being a lonely teenager sitting at the, you know, basement of the Don Treader bookstore looking for James Blish Star Trek paperbacks. Like, I'm glad that weird kids now can go on the internet and find their kind and have a peer group and all that. Like, I'm not lonesome for that time, but I feel like, you know, there was a moment in time in the 70s and 80s when weird was hard to find, you know, and you'd find something like the Church of the Subgenius in a scene or in a book. I mean, I don't even remember how I first heard of them, to be honest with you, but it was pre-internet, you know?
Yeah. I was working at a bookstore and found them.
Yeah, and just knowing that there was somebody out there who had, who knowing that your people were out there, you know, and I think that's very much how I felt when I discovered things like Monty Python and the Church of the Subgenius and some of the more sort of weird comedy things, you know.
Yeah.
Like, and look, it's a lot better now that if you're a weirdo, you can go on the internet and you'll find every weirdo who likes the same weird shit you like, and you'll have friends immediately, you know. Like, that's pretty cool, and I'm glad that's how life is now.
Yeah.
But there's a weird sort of romantic quality to there being to high weirdness being something that came in the mail and that it took a long time to find it, and you know, you'd send a check out hoping to get your Subgenius package and hoping that those people were still out there doing what they did and all that, you know.
Yeah.
And look, honestly, I would love for Middleman to be on Netflix and to be better known. But in, you know, if I had to look for a silver lining to our lack of a streaming deal, it would be that I, you know, the people who find the Middleman, they're looking for it, you know, and people find it because, you know, they have a friend like you who tells them there's this thing, and then they go find that thing, and then they tell a friend, and it's almost like it's I feel like I have a zine or a punk band or something in some very odd way, you know.
The old saying about the Velvet Underground that only 100 people bought their first album, but all 100 of those people started a band that you heard.
Yes. Well, I don't know if I can claim that, but that's a form of fame that's pretty great to have. If you know, I'm sure that Lou Reed would have liked to have had a steady source of income. You know, he might have been a nicer dude from what I hear, but and sometimes we just create these narratives of that being cool for ourselves to justify that, you know, that the show isn't still on the air. So
I was amazed that I kept being the reason that the co-host that was with me had seen it at all. I really thought I had more friends that had at least seen half of the season. And then I kept realizing, like, oh, cool, I foisted this on a dozen people.
No, that was one of the most gratifying things to hear in the podcast, was just hearing, you know, everybody saying, oh, you introduced me to this. And I'm like, that's just how most people are going to find out about my show. Somebody who likes weird is going to tell them, hey, if you like weird, have some of this really weird, you know. And then they'll have some weird, and they'll tell a weird friend, and the next thing you know, we're all just weird together, you know?
And Javi, thank you so much for following along on the podcast and all the time and the help with access. I can't say thanks enough. It's been wonderful doing this.
Oh, no, the gratitude is bilateral, man. It's been a real pleasure listening to it and listening to you talk about the show with your co-host. And interviewing my colleagues, and also, you know, it's really easy, I think, to lose faith in the entertainment business, because it is so commercial and the stakes are so high. And you know, you do a lot of different jobs, and some you love, some you don't like as much. And I think that you know, I honestly feel like you've done me a much bigger service than I have done you, because it has reminded me on some level of. There was a great moment in the podcast at one point when somebody asked quite pointedly the question of, who is this show for? I don't remember which episode it was, but the answer is obviously me. The fact that there are people who share that sense of oddity and that delight is the kind of thing that reminds you that, you know, sometimes you do this thing for money. Sometimes you do it to keep a roof over your head. And if you do that long enough, you sometimes get the chance to put something in the world that's really yours, and that maybe you are not as arcane and easily misunderstood as you think you are. So, and when you see that, that's when you realize that that's why you're doing this and not any other reason. So truly, thank you, Les. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great rest of your night.
All right, man. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
The Good Die Young is an independently run podcast produced by Les Weiler and hosted as part of the Permanent Record Network. We can be found on the web at thegooddieyoungtv.com. Les can be found doing weekly television commentary at www.thetvdudes.com. Thanks for listening.